This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll talk a little bit about these two mergers and see what they tell us about what's going on these days in the airline industry. Some people say that this is the logical conclusion of the deregulation process that was begun some 20 years ago, and that really wasn't exactly the idea, that there would eventually be consolidation to the point where we might be talking about just a handful of major airlines dominating the American market. We'll also talk about how people in Washington, in Congress, and in the administration might be thinking these days about the airline industry, and what they may think about all of the complaints that we hear about the fares that people have to pay and the quality of service. There is some discussion that this year in Washington, in Congress, they might actually be talking about something like an airline passenger's bill of rights. We'll be talking about all of these things this morning with our guest, Darryl Jenkins. He is director of the Aviation Institute at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He is probably one of the best-known authorities on aviation in Washington. He was a member of the Executive Committee of the White House Conference on Aviation Safety and Security. Is frequently interviewed on news nationally. He's been involved in the airline travel business for 20 years. He actually began as a travel agent in 1974. His background in aviation includes consulting work for a number of major airlines, as well as doing a lot of writing. He's, in fact, authored several books. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, you certainly should feel free. You folks who are listening should feel free to call in. Maybe you have some questions of your own to ask. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Jenkins, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's nice to chat with you.
I think maybe I'd like to start by talking just a little bit about these two proposed mergers.
Okay.
And maybe we'll take them in the order that they came. So we'll start talking about the United proposal to buy U.S. Airways that came last year. And I guess in some sense I can understand what's in this for U.S. Air and what's in the other deal for TWA, because they're not in neither of the airlines, particularly TWA, is in terribly good shape.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the question I'm interested in having you talk about, and let's again take the United case first, is what's in this for United?
I think most of the larger network carriers, the ones that run hub and spokes, want to they have two choices in terms of growth. One, they can grow organically, where they add flights on and invade markets where they have little market share and duke it out for a number of years, trying to get a toehold in a market, or you can go into those markets and buy another carrier who's already there. So I assume from the side of United that they feel it's probably easier to consolidate or merge with another airline in an area that they want to grow into, rather than going through some real bloody wars over that might last for 5 to 10 years, trying to gain a toehold in new markets. They don't have a whole lot of flights on the East Coast, although they have some very profitable routes that run transcontinental from the East to the West that they do quite well with. But they want to do more north-south traffic in the eastern part of the United States, and they want to get from that also more feed for their international routes.
Hmm. I guess I assume that here the story for the American purchase of TWA is essentially the same, although this, I gather, was particularly in response to the United deal, because American was wanting to position itself as put itself in the same ranks essentially with United.
Well, there are two really different carriers. United does very well going into the Orient and dominates there. American does very well and dominates in Latin America. So they, in terms of their global presence, are very different carriers, and they're both reasonably strong in Europe. So they have different niches that they work in the marketplace. The TWA deal, as it turned out, is in terms of just business acquisitions. may turn out to be one of the best business deals ever made in the airline industry. TWA, even though financially it's kind of a dog with fleas, does a very good job of operating the St. Louis hub. So they have good on-time traffic. They maintain their planes well and do basically what an airline should do in terms of moving people between point A and point B. So I think that will be a relatively painless merger if they take their time and don't do it rapidly. TWA, on the other hand, while it ran a good operation, had really been killed some years earlier by Carl Icahn, who took the airline private when other airlines were expanding and basically shrunk the airline, ended up having to sell its most profitable routes to have cash to keep it going. And then in its bankruptcy filing, when he ended up guaranteeing their pension funds, took a block of very discounted tickets, which because of that, today TWA really has no chance of making any money whatsoever. So if American Airlines takes over TWA, they're going to be able to rewrite their airplane leases. And that alone will save TWA $100 million a year in cost. Mm-hmm. And that one step alone will make TWA within an American Airlines organization profitable. And then American is a much better pricer than TWA is. They never really invested in the automation that they needed in the late 70s or 80s to do pricing correctly. So over time, TWA in St. Louis under the name of American Airlines will become a very profitable entity.
You know, I did have read some things about this this arrangement between Icahn and TWA, and also came across one comments by Donald Carty, who's chairman and CEO or chief executive of American, who said at the news conference when he announced the deal, he said, "This is one of the contracts we're not interested in being party to," and you know you can't blame the guy for that. But I guess is there some way for American to dodge that, or in buying TWA, do they just simply have to take that on?
No, they do not have to take that on, and TWA does not exist anymore after the merger.
Okay.
And now Carl Icahn, being Carl Icahn, will fight it tooth and nail in court, so we're going to get a great soap opera out of this one way or another.
If these two deals are approved, and we'll come to the question of if in a moment, but if they are approved, then the two companies domestically would control half of the market.
I don't know if it's exactly
half that
the market. How it goes is like this. Uh-huh. They use a measurement in airlines called a revenue passenger mile. Now, United flies big planes into the Orient, so that makes their revenue passenger miles very high. Right now, few people realize this, but the two biggest carriers domestically in terms of traffic is first Delta. Delta carries more passengers than anyone else. The second largest carrier, and this may surprise you, of domestic passengers is Southwest.
Hmm.
The third largest carrier, just of passengers, not how far they fly, but of passengers within the United States, is United. The fourth one's American, the fifth one's Northwest. So it's one of these things, depending on the measurement you use, the answers will change. But certainly American and United, if these mergers go through, will be very large, dominant carriers in certain areas of the country. Of that, there is no doubt.
Hmm. The question is then, how do the next largest airlines respond?
Mm-hmm.
Delta, Northwest, Continental together, and again, the figure that I have is together, they have something like 35% mm-hmm. of the domestic market. The other two companies, the result of the merger of American and TWA and United and U.S. Air, would clearly be much bigger than mm-hmm. than Delta, Northwest, and Continental, and it invites the question, how do they respond, and would they indeed be forced into some kind of deal? For example, some people say, well, the only way now that Delta could really rival or compete with the two bigger boys would be to buy Northwest.
Uh-huh.
Is it possible then we're going to see yet another sort of a merger if these other two go through?
I assume something else will happen. You're certainly correct in making the assumption that Delta feels threatened. They have a very large and a very profitable hub in Atlanta, largest origin and destination hub in the United States. If United were in the Southeast, they would be expanding their Charlotte. U.S. Air has a hub in Charlotte, which they really haven't done much with. United has stated, though, that they would expand that aggressively. So for the first time, we would see a major airline going into Delta Airlines' catchment area in the Southeast. Now, in the last 2 years, Delta has really gotten its fanny whipped bad, if I may say it like that, by Southwest and Florida. And Delta Airlines right now has probably $1 billion of revenue at risk against Southwest Airlines in Florida. Southwest now does the most traffic into and out of Florida and within Florida. So there's a whole lot of money at risk all over the place for Delta. So Delta is probably feeling the heat greatly right now. There are some options. One, we know in the past they wanted to buy Continental. Now, Continental kind of rebuffed them and went with Northwest and then decided they didn't like Northwest and actually joined the government in an antitrust suit to get out of the merger, which they had done with Northwest. It was kind of the Marx Brothers of mergers, is how I viewed it at the time. Now, they finally split their deal apart, but in doing so, Northwest retained the right to turn down other companies who wanted to buy Continental. So it becomes very complicated now. So if Delta were to want to buy Continental, they would have to get permission from Northwest, which would make that expensive. Now, we have some interesting personalities at play here, too. Gordon Bethune, who is the CEO of Continental, is one of the most interesting men I have ever met. Continental, and I don't know if you can remember this, 10 years ago, they had been through a number of bankruptcies. They were pretty much on the ropes, just like TWA has been. And Gordon Bethune came in 1 year turned them around. And since then, every year they've won the J.D. Power Award. And Gordon is so convinced of his company's product that I cannot see him, knowing him the way I do, wanting to be purchased. He's going to want to go out and purchase somebody, and I think that's what's going to happen. So Delta has few options. Now, there's some other airlines out there like Alaska, America West, which has really become a dog with fleas. But, you know, there are options out there for them to look at. And it will be interesting to see how they ultimately react. But the truth is, these guys are under attack.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus. We're talking with Darryl Jenkins. He's director of the Aviation Institute at the George Washington University and knows a lot about aviation in this country, has written on it, does a lot of speaking on the topic, is often interviewed in media, and has been good enough to spend some time talking with us this morning about what's been going on recently in the industry. Questions are welcome, of course, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, let me ask you a question that it's speculative in nature, but a lot of people in Washington are saying, as far as these two deals are concerned, we need to look at them very, very carefully. Do you think, you know, given what you know right at this point, what do you think the likelihood of these two deals, that is the American purchase of TWA and United of U.S. Air, being approved?
I think given that, well, we know that when United wanted to buy U.S. Air that they started negotiations with the Justice Department. And the Justice Department came to them with a list of concerns, of things that they were worried about in terms of the creation of monopoly power if this merger were to go through. Now, we recently saw U.S. Air spin off about 20% of the assets of U.S. Airways to American. Now, that was done clearly to placate Justice Department concerns. Now, I think there are some other concerns, although I'm not involved in these directly. If I were Justice, I would have some other concerns as well on some small routes, not carrying a whole lot of traffic into parts of Virginia and New York and things like that, where a U.S. Airways United merger would have basically 100% of the traffic on those routes. So I think there may be a few more things that Justice comes to United and asks them to do. Now, We saw recently in the AOL Time merger, which is really the model of how DOJ works. They kind of give them loose guidelines. They respond to them, and then DOJ either accepts it or it doesn't. If it doesn't, it makes additional demands. And the companies who are merging will either respond to them or say, this is no longer worth it. And so these are kind of the options, I think, now available to United and U.S. Air in their merger. So we see that going forward. I assume perhaps 90% of Justice Department's concerns are met. I have no idea how strong any remaining objections are and what Justice is going to ask of United and how United's going to react. But certainly United's done a major carve-out of U.S. Air to make people at Justice happy. Now, at TWA and American, that's an entirely different deal. And now if the United-U.S. Air deal does not go through, then American does not end up with 20% of U.S. Air's assets because they're contingent upon that merger going through. The TWA is kind of separate and apart. Now, I don't see a whole lot of problems with that, maybe on some routes in some particular areas, but TWA is really not a player. Even in St. Louis, their hub, they only have one hub. They do not do the majority of the originating traffic into and out of St. Louis. Southwest has a very big presence there. So they're not much of a player, and outside of St. Louis, they're really nothing. And even within St. Louis, they're not what you'd call a dominant carrier. So I don't see a whole lot of problems there. That looks like it will have reasonably clear sailing with some small glitches in it. And the thing that will be the great drama in that is the bankruptcy court, because ultimately TWA will be sold through a competitive auction that will be done by the bankruptcy court. So I assume the price American's going to pay for TWA is going to go north a tad.
Well, we have a caller here and would welcome others if people have questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also toll-free around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel, 800-222-9455. This caller is locally here in Urbana where we are. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. Thanks very much. I wish the guest would comment generally on what I tend to call the romance. Indeed, the epidemic of deregulation that's now seen sweeping over everything, power in California, I mean, that began in 1978 with the airlines under President Jimmy Carter. Thanks to deregulation, it seems to me, we now have a situation in which two airlines are going to control 50% of the business. We have inadequate airports. We have the whole panoply of problems, traffic clogs, unwanted delays, inconvenient routings, baggage problems, flights canceled without warning. Can you give me your appraisal, please, of the whole approach to airlines and other vital services of deregulation?
Yeah, it's a reasonable question, and I thank you for it. Let's split it into two parts, things dealing with deregulation and things not. For example, air traffic control and airport capacity, which I consider two of the biggest problems we face today. The airlines were deregulated and did what they were supposed to. They stimulated traffic, and since 1978, we've seen well over 200% increase above and beyond what we would have expected under regulation in terms of people traveling. And during these 20-some years, we've seen what I refer to as the democratization of the skies, where when I started out on this industry, and it's been so long that I'm almost afraid to think back that far, in the early 70s as a travel agent, I remember few people could afford to fly, and most planes were, in fact, empty. In Scottsdale, Arizona, where I lived, we had a very wealthy population, and they flew, but my parents did not. My brothers and sisters did not. And now my parents, who are surviving, fly all over the place, as do my brothers and sisters. My students, every time they have a weekend off and I'm not loading them down with homework or some sort of a break, they get in a plane and go somewhere in the world. And we never saw that when I was a kid. I really feel I missed out a lot of my youth of comparing that with the things that my students do now. That is entirely a function of deregulation. It would never have happened in a million trillion years under some sort of a government scheme. Now, the airlines did what they were supposed to, but the government did not increase capacity really one iota during that period. In 1981, we fired all the controllers and basically started over from scratch in terms of air traffic management. And we put in an air traffic management system that was basically designed to slow down the flow of traffic to the point that the new controllers could handle. In addition, we've seen airports, one of the most difficult things to do is to put a new runway at an airport where they need it. Every place in the United States where there is a new runway being planned, there is a well-financed and very vocal group there locally opposing it. So we have this real interesting dilemma that air traffic is supposed to double in the next 10 years, whereas the infrastructure which is needed to accommodate that traffic will not grow by more than 2 or 3% over the same time period. So at a certain point, which we are already reaching, the skies are full. Now, they're only full in a sense, in a sense where we can't manage them. But I want you to go out downtown Urbana, look up in the sky during rush hour, and count the number of planes you see. And there aren't any. The sky is three-dimensional. There is so much airspace that is unbelievable, and yet we control it as if it were a two-dimensional, two-lane highway. Okay, so we have some real problems because of this. Now, these problems, as we found out last June, were so severe that if we were in a period, and as it was, we had 20 days of bad weather out of 30, that the system backed up so far that entire days' worth of flights had to be canceled just to get the people who were stranded at airports to their final destinations. Now, in each case, an airport is generally, with maybe one exception, locally owned and operated, and these decisions have to be made locally. And as I know from Washington, local politics are the meanest and the toughest. Now, people who live within a community have the right to make decisions concerning their community. At the same time, there will be consequences which will be born because of these decisions. Now, at Washington National, here where I live, in the last 10 years, each year the aggregate level of noise has gone down. Each year, local opposition to noise has increased. And I don't think this is just a local Washington phenomena. So this is my forecast, okay? I don't want anybody to be depressed about this. I don't want anybody to feel bad. But in fact, it will get worse. It will get worse to the point where it is so intolerable that something will be done, and nothing will be done until it is completely and totally intolerable. And at that point, government officials in Washington, D.C. will 100% make the wrong decision.
Well, have we asked the caller, have we answered your question?
What is the wrong decision?
Well, we in the 1990s, we had four presidential commissions discuss the problems of capacity in gridlock. Each one agreed on solutions and the time frame at which gridlock would approach us. And during those same 10 years, Congress, who has oversight and authority over these issues, did absolutely nothing. And Congress as a body generally doesn't do anything until well past the time a problem has peaked. We needed a new bridge across the Potomac here going into Maryland called the Wilson Bridge. They've argued over it for 10 years. Now that construction is starting, they're stopping it. And that bridge is literally falling piece by piece into the Potomac River. In another 3 or 4 years, will be dangerous to drive over. And so I'm very pessimistic about governments acting and doing the right thing, especially with respect to our nation's infrastructure. In the time I've been here, I've seen everybody argue this. I've seen commission after commission. I've seen study after study, not only in the United States but in Europe, discuss these problems. And not one place have we seen a government body take real action to solve problems. Now, let me just be a little bit positive. Norm Mineta, who is our new Secretary of Transportation, could be the one of the few people who we've ever had in that job who clearly understands the problem and has the ability to bring very diverse warring parties together to create solutions. Jane Garvey, who is at the Federal Aviation Administration, has the same capabilities. So if the problem can be solved, we've got the team in place between Mineta and Garvey to push this forward. Even with them in there, as good as they are, it will be extremely difficult.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Let me introduce once again our guest. We're talking with Darrell Jenkins. He's director of the Aviation Institute at the George Washington University in the Washington, D.C. area.
I hate to be such a pessimist.
You need to call him like you see him. He has been working in the aviation area for a long time, studying and writing about it. He was a member of the Executive Committee of the White House Conference on Aviation Safety and Security. That was during the Clinton administration, and now is often interviewed in media on various topics that have to do with the air industry. And questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I think as the caller suggested, and as you noted, the thing that people complain most about when it comes to air travel are delays, mm-hmm. And that those delays are attributed to infrastructure issues. Mm-hmm. There was a piece of legislation that was adopted last year and went into effect at the beginning of fiscal 2001 last fall, something called the Air 21 Aviation Modernization Act. Mm-hmm. And I know that some members of Congress feel that this will help and that they perhaps feel a little bit disappointed that there hasn't been more attention given to this by the news media. Can you talk a little bit about what Air 21 is and will that help?
Well, it's better than a kick in the fanny, isn't it? It gives us 3 years of funding. It kind of loosens up some things which formerly had been very tight, and hopefully will create some sort of a performance-based organization at the FAA. Now, the FAA over the years has really, and I don't think I'm being unkind to them, has had a horrific record. General Accounting Office claims they've wasted over $20 billion in our taxpayer funds in projects for which we got no benefit. They have changed their strategy so many times over the years that I could not write a coherent history of what they've tried to do. So that has been problematic. Now, one of the reasons, if you look at it structurally, is there within an agency, there are really no incentives for people to ever complete things. Matter of fact, within a government agency, there are disincentives. You get a project done, and if you're a project manager, you're basically out of work. So you maintain your job and your status by keeping things moving as long as possible. That's how Washington works, right? Now, that's fine for most things because I really believe governments are best that govern the least. And if you look at our founding fathers, they really made, with checks and balances, assured us that things would move slowly. And the last thing that I want to see is a Congress that has a Newt Gingrich-type attitude that we're just going to change everything and we're going to change everything overnight. So Gingrich came in. He tried a revolution. The Senate killed it. The president wouldn't have signed it anyways. So things are supposed to go slowly. Now, the FAA, having trashed them, let me say some kind things. In terms of the world, They do a better job at regulating safety than any other governmental body in the world. So they're good at regulation, and that's what you expect from a government. They do it as well as anybody. Okay, that might not be excellent, but in a relative sense, they're very good. Now, the same people who have this mindset of regulation have kind of an opposite mindset towards technology. So my students that come through my program that want to go into government regulation have a certain mindset. The people that come through are master students who want to go into business and technology. They're a different breed of cat. And the breed of cat you need to advance something that has a large technological component is not the same person who makes a good regulator. And so part of the problem with the FAA, as I see it, is that we've assigned them an impossible task. We tell them to build infrastructure, and that's like asking the Food and Drug Administration to also make the pills that they regulate. These people who regulate the system also supply 100% of the infrastructure. And I just don't see a government agency being able to do that. So somewhere or other in all of this, I think we have some big structural problems that have not been addressed yet, have been discussed thoroughly in this city, but we need some more work on. And I think ultimately, if we're to solve this problem and correct this need that we have for more infrastructure, we're going to have to see some structural changes in the way the FAA is organized.
Well, we have another caller here in Terre Haute, Indiana. Why don't we talk with them? And this is line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Deregulation, I think, worked pretty well for the first 10 or 15 years. I think adjusted for inflation, I probably had some of the lowest fares ever.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it not working now?
Well, I don't know that it's not working. I think it's working. The problem that we have is that we need more infrastructure. If we're going to double the number of travelers in the next 10 years and we do not have the capacity to put these people in the air, tell me, what is the one mechanism that a business can use to ration scarce commodities? There's only one thing you can do. And that is you have to raise prices. So as a commodity becomes scarce, and the scarcity is in fact a government-created scarcity, over the next 10 years, we will have to see prices go up faster in real terms than they went down in the previous 20 years. That is the only way we're going to be able to manage demand for travel. Now, we're already seeing that at slot-controlled airports. So if you fly into and out of Chicago O'Hare, which is slot controlled, which is a scarcity created by a government, you will pay higher fares than if you fly into non-slot controlled airports. So it's really easy to see that as we create scarcity due to a lack of infrastructure, and this is what the future is.
Well, why wouldn't there be new startup airlines like we had under deregulation that would fly to these non-slot?
Well, the startups are going to have the same problem. So we see AirTran, which wants to expand international, cannot because there's no space. So the startups are feeling the same pressures at certain airports as everyone else is feeling, and this is a problem. Now, startup airlines, we're seeing a real interesting breed. During the 1980s, we didn't see too many very good startups. We had America West, which did well, went bankrupt, did well and is doing poorly because it has just such awful management. We had Southwest, which really is a dominant carrier in many markets now. Then in the 90s, we had more successful startups. The new millennia started out with JetBlue, which could well be the most successful startup ever next to the Southwest, but its ability to run in and out of JFK is constrained, and it's noticing now that at certain parts of the day that its operations are less efficient because of congestion. So congestion will be the biggest problem we face under airline deregulation. In my own mind, I think of this as a failed partnership, where the airlines were to do one thing, the government was to do one thing, the government didn't ante up like they were supposed to. It's no use now pointing fingers, but this is the situation, and it is not good, and I honestly think it will get worse.
Well, it seems to me like at O'Hare, probably 70 to 80% of those passengers are not originating from there, and that's not their destination either. So it would seem like building a hub at some location downstate in Illinois or Indiana would solve that whole problem.
Well, a hub's an interesting thing, and you need to have an area with connecting traffic. I don't know if you realize this or not. Connecting traffic is more expensive, so you have a higher cost for connecting traffic than you do for originating traffic because you have to transfer their baggage more. You have to add additional infrastructure for them. So in order to be able to do connecting traffic, you have to have a larger number of people who pay the walk-up fare, certain types of businesses. In Chicago, you have Arthur Anderson and all of these other large consulting firms who are willing to pay higher ticket prices to make sure they have inventory available to them. And you have to be able to have that situation to create and run a hub. You cannot just stick a hub out in the middle of nowhere. You have to have a large business community to support the operations of a hub. So the economics don't work of a hub other than in very large population areas.
Well, there's still other large population areas in the Midwest that...
I think one of the reasons American wanted St. Louis is just for what you were stating. American can no longer expand in Chicago. They're kind of landlocked there now. They want to grow in the Midwest, and the only way to do it was to expand out of St. Louis. We've seen certain cities like Kansas City, for some reason, have never been able to support a hubbing airline there profitably. I doubt that anybody will look at them seriously in the future, but you're certainly right. We need to look carefully at how we do hubbing. And I do not think it is unreasonable as we get into more and more congestion that we will see the development of secondary hubs. Hartford, Connecticut, a non-congested airport, a good business community. You won't get as hub as you have in Chicago here, but nonetheless, you could do some sort of a regional feed out of Hartford. I'm not familiar enough with all the places in the Midwest to be able to name them. We're looking at some here. Dulles is a good hub. Baltimore, Washington with Southwest developed a very profitable hub there, which is now plugging up to the Southwest own success. So it will be different 5 to 10 years from now than it currently is. And I certainly agree with you that we're going to look at secondary hubs. How much different, I don't know, but it will be different. It has to be different because right now we're bursting at the seams, and I don't think we need to be.
We're hit the point here where we just have about 10 minutes left, and I have another caller here, and I hope the last caller will forgive me for wanting to go on, and I should also introduce again our guest. We're talking with Darrell Jenkins. He is director of the Aviation Institute at the George Washington University, and we're talking about the airline business. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller next in Belgium, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering, maybe I'm naive, but why couldn't an airline start that would go from definitely just regional airports, say from very small airports like, I don't know, maybe someplace in western Maryland and maybe someplace in Ohio and someplace in Indiana, and just pick small airports and just move their planes from step to step for people who might not be so concerned about getting there fast but not to be always delayed and, canceled and stuff?
No, it's a perfectly reasonable question. Let me try to get into the economics of this without going into too much detail. to make money in an airline is really simple. I mean, it boils down to some real simple basics. You have to put people's bodies in airplane seats, and they have to be paying a tad more than it costs to transport them, all right?
Yeah.
The problem you have in small areas is just mass. So between two small markets, you generally don't see enough bodies to get all the service that you want. Now, so airlines, to accommodate that, use smaller and smaller planes. Generally, at a certain point, what I've found is people don't really like turboprops. So we see what's happening is that in many cases, the first segment of an airplane trip is a person getting into their car and driving to a distant airport rather than going turboprops. Now, as we get regional jets, that's going to some people who are nervous about turboprops, that will take care of them. But the problem always is in smaller communities having bodies. Now, let me, just so you understand how big of a problem this is, let me give a big example. At Washington Dulles, United flies two flights a day to Paris. Now, you would think in Washington, with 3 million people, you could do that easily. But the fact is that from the Washington area, we only contribute 100 flyers to each of their two flights. And all of the other people who are on that plane going over to Paris, they bring in from feed from outlying areas, some of which are as far north as Buffalo, New York. So the whole genius of the hub and spoke is that it kind of consolidates people in one place, which makes more frequency available to them, and at the same time makes it possible to fly larger planes. And you need some sort of a collection system to be able to do that. Now, the airlines that do the linear system, like you were talking about, Southwest, fly from very high populated areas to other high populated areas, but they do it at satellite airports within them. So in New York, they fly out of Islip. In Boston, they actually fly out of Providence, Rhode Island, 50 miles down the road, and you drive there as the first leg of your trip. So I think something is going to change. I mean, we have to because we're running out of opportunities. I'm just not sure how it's going to change, and that's what's going to be interesting to follow on my side over the next 5 to 10 years. But your question's a perfectly good one.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. We're coming down to the point here. We have maybe about 3 minutes or so. Unfortunately, there's a lot of other things we could talk about. But I want to get to the issue of the possibility that in Congress, people are going to be talking about some kind of passenger bill of rights.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Ron Wyden of Oregon did draft such a piece of legislation, but withdrew it last year in the hopes that apparently the airlines would get their acts together on their own. He had some partnership on this with others, including John McCain. There's another senator, Harry Reid from Nevada, who's sponsoring something called the Airline Passenger Fair Treatment Act. So people are talking about it, and according to what I read, many people on the Hill say, you know, this year we're really seriously going to be talking about this. What do you think the possibility is that they'll move beyond talking about it and actually passing something?
Well, I think it's a reasonable chance that they will. Here's how Congress acts. When a problem exists, and they're in fact the cause of that problem, they will do a lot of talking. They might even pass legislation, but it'll be the wrong thing. If delays are a problem of capacity, Wyden, McCain, and Harry Reid are the ones who over the last 10 years have had a half dozen reports on their desk telling them about this problem. The reason we have these problems with delays is because these men have done nothing about it. So I'm sure that they will do something because this is how Congress acts. And this is from someone who's lived in Washington for too long and is too cynical about the process.
Hmm. We just going back for a second to this issue of what deregulation hath wrought. And now here, if the two deals we talked about at the beginning of the program go through, and if something happens with the other next bigger carriers, Delta, Northwest, Continental, we could be looking at going from a time here now where the domestic market has six major carriers to a point where we might cut that in half. So we would have three. And I think people would look at the intent of deregulation and say, you know, that wasn't the idea. There was supposed to be more competition and more choice. And in fact, some people would say that what happened was when deregulation began, yes, there was a move in the right direction, but that the big carriers of the time decided they were going to go out and crush the competition, which they proceeded to do while the Reagan and Bush administrations essentially looked the other way. Anything to that kind of analysis?
Well, if you look at the big carriers at the time, the biggest carrier during the Reagan era was Texas Air. The second biggest carrier before that was Pan Am. Those are the airlines that lost the battles. Making money in the airline business is very difficult. Let me show you how difficult it is. Over a one-year period of time, per flight, this is adjusting for your heavy seasons and your load seasons, you only make money on one passenger per flight. That's how sensitive airlines are to changes in load factors. And so if anything happens that you don't have control over, your fuel prices go up, your labor gets mad at you, or there's an economic downturn and there are fewer people on that flight, you're going to lose money. This is one of the most difficult businesses in the world to make money at. It does not surprise me that many have failed. What surprises me is that we have as many as we do.
Well, we'll have to stop there. It's a fascinating area, and I wish we could continue, but we've used our time, so we have to say at this point to our guest, Mr. Jenkins, thank you very much for being with us.
I've enjoyed it immensely.
Our guest, Darrell Jenkins, he's director of the Aviation Institute at the George Washington University, which is in Washington, D.C.